For the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Law Hour is an educational service to public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour, an editorial review, brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on inflation when we come back. You know, we Americans talk a lot about private business, and we use terms like private ownership, private property, and private rights. But we also use terms like stocks, bonds, negotiable instruments, licenses, and permits in our pursuit of profit and gain in our business transactions. Well, listen to this. Did you know that stocks and negotiable instruments are the exact opposite to private ownership? Bonds are the exact opposite to private property. Business licenses are the exact opposite to private rights. Permits are the exact opposite to private business. And why is it that we see small business being subjected to such a constant barrage of attacks by government at every level from Washington to your hometown? And what can you do to protect your life, your liberty, and your property from these incessant attacks by government agencies like OSHA, the EPA, the State Tax Commission, Zoning and Planning, the IRS, and the swarms of government agents and agencies who are eating out your substance? Well, you know, there's a lot that you can do, and the first step is to inform yourself as to the legal alternatives that you have between public business and private business. Now, if you'd like to learn more about private business, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? That's the place to start. And let me tell you more about what it is that you're not supposed to know about private business. It's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. You can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. If you're online, why don't you go to the website georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and request your free general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about inflation. You ever wonder what causes inflation? Most people would say, well, it's the constant rise in prices. The constant rise in prices in reality is the result of inflation. It's not the cause. There's a cause and effect relationship for everything that we do in life. The world works based upon law, and there are physical laws out there. Economics just happens to be one of those subjects that is subject to physical law. If you do certain things, you'll get certain results. And when we hyperinflate our currency, which is what we're doing now in the year 2005, we can expect at some future date hyperinflation, hyperinflationary prices, prices that go up every month. Now, the way it is today, we expect prices to go up every year. We know that next year's automobiles will probably be more expensive than this year's automobiles, that the price of gasoline next year will be more than it is this year. But we like our increases to be modest. 3% a year is what we're told is acceptable. And we've learned that from the time we went to college. Remember that when you went to school and they said, well, 3% is good for the economy, it stimulates business, and everything's honky-dory. Now, just do the arithmetic, all of you economists out there. 3% a year compounded for 25 years cuts the purchasing price or the value of your money in half every 25 years. Now, 25 years is a long span of time, so most people would say, well, you know, if it cuts my purchasing power in half over 25 years, that's okay by me. But wait a minute, hang on a second. You remember when we used to buy those government bonds, those 20, 25, 30-year government bonds? Now, think about this. We go out and buy a $100 bond. Now, we could go down and buy a suit with this $100. We go down and we buy a bond. Now, we expect that this thing is going to pay us 4 or 5% per year over the next 25 or 30 years. Let's take 25 years. Do you know what the inflation rate was between 1960 and 2000? 5%. So if you were getting 5% interest on your money, in 1960 you bought this $100 bond, and in the year 2000 you're expecting to get 5% a year compounded now for 40 years. At the end of 40 years, you know what you got, partner? Well, the amount of money that you made just kept abreast of inflation. So when you got all through, you loaned the government your $100, and when you got through, you got $100 back, because it's going to take about 10 times, which is about what you've earned with your 5% compounded. You've just about doubled your money over here a couple of times, and that 5% for 40 years just kept up with inflation, and you broke even, which is better than losing money, better than losing money. But you thought you made some money, and in fact, you did. In dollar terms, you got several hundred dollars back. You put in 100 and you got 500 back. And you say, wow, I made $400 by loaning the government 100 bucks. Now it just takes that whole $500 to buy what $100 would have bought back in 1960. That's what inflation does. It destroys savings and discourages investment. It destroys your savings. Now, that doesn't mean that inflation is 100% bad, because we have actually made marvelous gains in this inflationary period from 1933 until 2005. We're actually ahead of the game. Of course, we're in debt quite a bit, and that debt has a consequence. But, you know, we're all living better. We're driving newer cars and more of them. Back in the 30s, if you had an automobile, you were the exception to the rule. Today, if you don't have an automobile, there's something wrong with you. You know, today, 68% of Americans own their own homes. Well, they call themselves homeowners. They're living in a house that they're making payments on, but that house belongs to them. They have the first right of refusal. If they keep making their payments, they can stay in there. If they want to sell the house, they can. If they make a profit, great. And if they make a loss, that's too bad. But that's 68%. Now, you go back here 70 years, you know, 68% of people were not homeowners. Well, back in 1979, our country went through the worst period of inflation in our history. We had interest rates of 20% or more. We had inflation of around 15% per annum. I mean, prices were going up every year, not 3%. You know, it wasn't the price of gasoline going up a nickel or a dime. It was the prices of everything going up 10 or 15%. Now, it's not unheard of to have inflation of 10%. In the last 200 years, we've had a few years that hit that, especially during the Civil War and the period right after that. World War I, World War II, there were periods when there were short bursts of inflationary gains, you know, in prices of 10% or more. But from 1978, 79, 80, 81, in that 4 or 5 year period, I mean, we went through the worst possible period. And Reader's Digest wrote an article, and it's called What Really Causes Inflation? It's time to face up to the fact that there's one basic cause of inflation and only one way to stop it. Now, remember, in our first program, I gave you the answer to the riddle. What causes inflation is the government printing press turning out too much credit. Now, the Figge report said, you know, if we don't stop this insanity, there's going to be a consequence. Well, we didn't stop the insanity, and now we're on the verge of the consequence, hyperinflation. Now, we've heard of hyperinflation in Brazil, Bolivia, Ecuador, Peru, the Banana Republics, Germany, China, Japan. We Americans have never thought of hyperinflation here in America. Well, get ready, boys and girls, because it's about to descend upon us. How did people in the past deal with hyperinflation, and what can you do to protect yourself from the effects of the hyperinflation that's about to be unleashed, not just in the United States, but around the world? Well, how did the three-bedroom house that sold for $33,000 in 1969 become a $96,000 house in 1979? How could a family sedan that cost $3,000 10 years ago come in a smaller size today and it costs $6,500? And how is it that the man who retired in 1969 with a $9,000 annual pension and maximum Social Security benefits, up to 118% over the past 10 years, now he has 36% less purchasing power than he had back then 10 years ago, one-third less? He retired on $9,000 a year and has $6,000 worth of purchasing power. How does that happen? Well, inflation is the answer, of course, but what exactly is this thing that we call inflation? And what causes this phenomenon that silently robs all of us of our living, that in the past 40 years has shrunk the value of the dollar to 20 cents? Now, remember, this is back in 1979. So when we take a look at the dollar from 1930 to 1980, it shrank by 80 cents. Now, if you take a look at the dollar from 1930 to 2005, it shrunk by 97%, 97 cents. You've got 3 cents left. What happened, boys and girls? And is it really good? And if it's a good, why don't we have more of it? If 3% inflation per year is good, I submit to you that 6% ought to be twice as good. If 6% is twice as good as 3%, then it would look like to me that 12% inflation ought to be better yet. Now, I've never heard of anybody tell me that inflation is good, but they tell me that 3% inflation is acceptable. But 3% inflation isn't good, but 3% is acceptable. What if we had zero inflation? Did you know that between 1865 and 1900, we had a deflationary period? At the same time, we had the largest, the greatest growth in our nation's history was in that 35 years from 1865 to 1900. We built 186,000 miles of railroad. We built cities. We created the robber baron era. I mean, we produced during that 35 years more than we have in any 35-year period before since. And if you put $100 in the bank in 1865, that $100 would have had $102 worth of purchasing power. In addition to the interest you made off of it, you had 2% greater purchasing power 35 years later than you had when you started. Now take a look at the period from 1930 to 2000 or 2005, and the purchasing power is 3 cents of what it was in 1930. Now that's inflation. It's not hyperinflation. We've got that penalty yet to face. That's coming in the future. But by 1979, we'd lost 80%. By the year 2005, that's 25 years later, we've now lost another 17 cents worth of purchasing power. To understand inflation, one must first understand what's being inflated. It isn't prices, although they certainly are rising, and it isn't wages, which they also are rising. You make more dollars per hour today than you did 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years ago. But that's not inflation. It is the supply of money, currency, and bank credit. The real wealth of the nation is the goods and services that are produced by its people. It's called the gross domestic product. That's the real wealth. Money, coined or printed by the government, is merely a convenient symbol of that wealth. Now, we give part of our wealth to the government in taxes, but the government has been spending vastly more wealth than we give it, at least up to this date, over $766 billion more. In addition, it has run up future financial commitments, such as Social Security pensions, loan guarantees, that are in excess of $7 trillion, more than $71,000 per taxpayer. Now, that's back in 1979. That $7 trillion has grown to $43 trillion today in 2005. Now, how can the government spend more than we give it? Well, usually by monetizing its debts, by simply printing more symbols than there is real wealth. The basic law of economics, the more there is of something, the cheaper it becomes, applies to dollars also. As former Secretary of the Treasury William E. Simon puts it, the American dollar is being debased by its own government. The real problem with the dollar is that we're printing too many of them. And this is the root cause of inflation. More money poured into the economy than the economy is worth. Only when we accept this basic truth can we deal intelligently as citizens with the myths about inflation and put abroad daily in the press, classroom, and the government. Here are three of the most pernicious causes of inflation. Myth number one, people believe rising wages and prices cause inflation. That's a myth. Secretary of the Treasury Michael Blumenthal perpetuated this myth when he listed among the factors causing inflation wage settlements that substantially exceed the productivity and real growth of the economy and price increases that bring unjustified excess profits. In our competitive system, prices and wages are primarily signals of the ever-changing balance of supply and demand that takes place every day in billions of transactions in the American marketplace. Now, if there's only so much money, that is, so much money and so much credit in the entire economic system, a business cannot ignore supply and demand by arbitrarily raising its prices or by giving in to excessive wage demands. If its prices are too high, people will buy somewhere else. And if wage demands are too high, business must refuse to pay them or hire fewer workers at the new higher rate. Competition itself then is supposed to, and in fact does, keep a tight rein on prices. But this real discipline of the marketplace has been circumvented by government. To pay its bills and finance a broad list of social goals, including full employment, government generally inflates the money supply. It thereby abets higher wages and prices by fostering the notion that it will always create enough money to pay for them. And once the money supply has been increased and increasing rapidly for some time, prices seem to have an upward life of their own. Instead of saving people, buy now, hoping to beat future price increases. Unions seek contracts with cost of living clauses, banks lending money to be paid back and steadily cheapening dollars insist on higher interest rates. If rising wages in and of themselves were inflationary, then West Germany should have one of the most inflationary economies on planet Earth. German workers' wages increased 236% in the decade 1967 to 77, but the inflation rate averaged about 4% annually because the government kept the money supply in balance with the real productive wealth of the economy. U.S. workers during the same period saw their wages increase 101%, a rise nearly outpaced by inflation averaging over 6% a year. Now, the fact is, wages, for the most part, are reacting, in some cases overreacting, to government-caused inflation by creating too many dollars and too much credit. So what about these rising prices? Well, it is still popular to characterize the cataclysmic rise in oil prices since the oil embargo of 1973 as a major cause of inflation. But this is simply not true. The high oil prices added to our financial burdens, but they were clearly not the cause of the inflation. Let's consider the experience of Japan and West Germany during the embargo. Unlike the United States, both of these countries were almost entirely dependent upon foreign oil. But during the embargo, both countries, Germany and Japan, pursued prudent fiscal policies. They held down their budget deficits, and they kept a tight rein on the money supply. The result was inflation in both countries declined. while soaring to 12.2% in the United States as politicians cranked out printing press money to finance continued deficits, $130 billion from 1973 through 1976. And this, not an Arab hand on the oil spigot, was the real reason for the rising American inflation. It's not the higher price for oil, it's the manufacture of more and more dollars. Here's the second myth. Wage and price controls will cure inflation. Governments always turn to wage and price controls when inflation gets out of hand. It has never controlled, it has never stopped, nor has it ever eliminated rising prices by using wage and price controls. This popular delusion feeds on the first myth. Price controls have been imposed repeatedly for more than 2,000 years, or so notes Nobel Prize-winning economist Milton Friedman. They've always failed. Roman Emperor Diocletian used capital punishment in a futile effort to enforce controls in 301 AD. Thousands died and the economy was nearly wrecked. In 1775, the Continental Congress sought to finance our infant government's debt by authorizing the issue of an almost worthless paper money. A disastrous inflation followed. The Pennsylvania legislature sought to stem it with price controls. Many farmers and businessmen refused to sell at the controlled prices. Shortages developed. The Army, wintering at Valley Forge in 1777 and 78, could not get badly needed supplies. The Army's misery, wrote John Adams, was due largely to that improvident act for limiting prices, which, if not repealed, will ruin the state and introduce a civil war. Historical experiences like these underscore the well-known deficiencies of wage and price controls. Such controls create shortages, and many businesses cannot or will not produce at the artificially low prices. It results in a lowering of quality. The former standard features on a product become costly extras. And they are consistently circumvented. Black markets spring up. We call it the black market when there's wage and price controls. In reality, it's the free market. Now, they also require a large and expensive bureaucracy to administer these wage and price controls. During World War II, our longest flirtation with wage and price controls, we called it the Office of Price Administration, known as the OPA. It employed 65,000 bureaucrats who directed an additional 325,000 price control volunteers. But worst of all, while these controls may create an illusion of being effective, they only temporarily hold down wages and prices while the tremendous pressure of inflation continues to build up. Once the controls are lifted, the market spurts to find its natural level, and a more pronounced and damaging inflation is usually the result. This country's most recent attempt at price controls, the Nixon administration's Phase 1, Phase 2, and Phase 3, and Phase 4 program began in August of 1971, built up pressure for one of the worst inflationary explosions in the United States history. The rate of growth of consumer prices had been in decline at the time that the controls were instituted. This was the result of a cutback in money supply in the waning days of the Johnson administration. But during the period of controls, the consumer price index began a steep climb, reaching almost 13% by mid-1974. The disaster was compounded by a harrowing confluence of events. That was a worldwide crop failure and the Arab oil embargo. All occurred at the same time. Some people still entertain the idea that these factors caused the inflation of 1973-74. The fact is, the Nixon price controls were a facade behind which government spending increased very sharply. Why then do governments return to wage and price controls frequently with popular support? Well, a recent Gallup poll showed that about half the respondents in favor of some form of controls. The outcry for controls, contends Friedman, is based upon neither experience nor analysis, but rather on the for God's sake, let's do something syndrome. However, controls are not the answer, and when they are imposed by a government, that at the same time goes deeper into debt while printing more money to pay the bills. And myth number three, inflation is everybody's business. Well, according to President Carter, it was a myth that government itself can stop inflation. Success or failure in this overall effort will largely be determined by the actions of the private sector. That's what President Carter said. Now, while the president's assertion coincides with some theories of inflation, it contravenes the clear evidence of economic history and practical experience. As Milton Friedman points out, government has an effective printing press on which it can turn out green pieces of paper, and as a result, government and government alone is the source of inflation. The steady downward trend of the dollar since 1940, notes economic writer Henry Hazlitt, has been accompanied by an awesome growth of America's money supply. At the beginning of 1940, the U.S. currency and bank deposits totaled $52.7 billion. By January of 1978, currency and bank deposits totaled $816 billion. That's an increase of 1,448%. Now, inflation in Western European countries has been routinely running high with two dramatic exceptions, West Germany and Switzerland. West Germany has kept its inflation rate around 4%. Switzerland has kept their inflation rate below 2% in recent years, and both countries have displayed the political courage and citizen discipline to keep a tight rein on their money creation and on their budgets and on the growth of their money supply. Now, in the post-war era, there have been three major instances of inflation. These three major instances of inflation being brought under control. West Germany did it in 1948, refusing to spend its way to prosperity by running up huge deficits. The United States did it in 1953 under President Dwight D. Eisenhower, whose prudent fiscal policies led to an inflation rate during his administration of just 1.4% a year. France accomplished the feat in 1958 when Charles de Gaulle halved the government's budget deficit. In each case, control was achieved by dramatic cuts in government spending and a concomitant dialing down of the money machine. Unfortunately, neither France nor the United States stuck to its guns. The old predilection of politicians to give social benefits without taking or taxing asserted itself, and Americans now face a $500 billion plus budget, more than $60 billion of which the government can pay for only by turning out more phony money, and surging inflation that reached an annual rate of almost 10% last summer. The anti-inflation plan unveiled by President Carter last October imposes wage and price guidelines on business and labor as if they were the cause of the problem. The president did recognize the role of the budget deficit, comments Hazlitt, but he did not promise to eliminate. He promised only to reduce it over a period of years, and this was practically an assurance that our inflation will be continued. Clear away the myths, and one discovers that the way to stop inflation is to literally stop inflating. Stop inflating the money supply beyond the real ability of this country to produce. Stop pretending that we have more money than we really do. Stop running huge deficits that can be financed only with more fiat paper dollars. The United States cannot expect a painless extrication from the inflation in which it has found itself for almost 40 years. A broad range of programs will have to be cut back. Unemployment is likely to increase, at least temporarily. But as economic historian and monetary expert Donald Kimmerer warns, a nation that does not stop an inflation simply because it is politically painful to do so is essentially declaring bankruptcy. Well, boys and girls, bankruptcy is on the horizon. Now, we went through bankruptcy in the Great Depression in 1933. President Roosevelt raised the price of gold from $20.67 to $32 an ounce. The effect of that is when you contracted your debt, let's say you contracted a $100 debt, at $20 an ounce, you expected to be paid 5 ounces of gold. But when the price of gold was increased to $32, the net effect is you're going to get paid 3 ounces of gold instead of five, so you're going to take a 40% cut in the payment. That's what governments do when they go bankrupt. They don't go down to the courthouse and file a petition for Chapter 11 or Chapter 7 bankruptcy. They simply inflate their way out. They simply print more money until finally no one in his right mind will accept it any longer. That's where we're headed, boys and girls. Now, remember, that story comes from 1979, when we were going through our worst possible inflation. Now, inflation has heated up. The government now admits it's up to 6%. The real rate is 12%. The government always lies. At least, they always lie when it's necessary for government to lie to deceive us. They tell us the truth, and they mix it with lies and keep us deceived continually. Now, there's been inflation in this country since 1800. And there's been deflation since 1800. Well, from 1800 to 1933, the inflation and deflation just about balanced out. Prices in 1930 were about the same as they were in 1887, or 1787, or 1850, or 1820. When you put $100 in the bank, you could come back 20, 30, or 40 years later, draw your $100 out, and you hadn't lost your purchasing power. But today, when you deposited $100 in the bank in 1987, today it has 50 cents worth of purchasing power left. Not much of an incentive to save now, is it? All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. It can be accessed through the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, economics, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. Remember, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package to order yours. Just call the school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour, an editorial review, gives credit to the authors and publications used on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements and recommendations that we give do not necessarily mean that the authors or the publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. Most of the authors and the publications that we cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or of this local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website, georgegordon.org, or call the law school direct, 417-273-4967. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call the law school at 417-273-4967. Have we Americans ever had an experience with paper money in the past that we could look back to and learn from? An old adage tells us that he who refuses or fails to learn from the history or from the past is bound to repeat it. Well, the history of the first issue of bills of public credit, also known as inflation in the American colonies, began in 1690, and it went from 1690 to 1756. In Massachusetts, in December of 1690, the colony issued 7,000 pounds of printed bills of equal value with money. Money was gold and silver coin, and they printed this paper money. In May of 1691, they issued 30,000 pounds more of printed bills, and in July of 1692, they made all of these bills of public credit current within this province, in all payments equivalent to money, excepting specialties and contracts made before the publication of this new law. As a result of this action by Massachusetts, almost immediately all of the gold and silver coin then in Massachusetts was exported to England, and new stock followed as fast as it came in from abroad. Trade and commerce declined, and hard times came upon the people. In December of 1697, they passed legislation prohibiting the export of coin, silver, money, or bullion. In June of 1700, Massachusetts established a committee to consider how to revive trade and to find out some suitable medium to supply the scarcity of money. Note here that the word money in all colonial legislation was used exclusively for gold and silver coin. In November of 1702, the first issue of bills of credit of Massachusetts, after it became a royal province, for 10,000 pounds in real in value equal to money. In 1703, South Carolina enacted that not only its new emission of paper bills for 6,000 pounds should be a good payment and tender in law, but that whoever should refuse them should forfeit double the value of the bills so refused. For a short time, from June 1716, the fine was treble the value. Well, Great Britain in 1709 made a sudden requisition on the American colonies to aid in the conquest of the French possessions in North America. To meet this expense, all of the New England colonies emitted paper bills, and the paper of each one of them found some circulation in all of the others. New Hampshire in 1709, original act by which New Hampshire emitted its first paper money was destroyed by fire. A supplemental act of the following year seems to show that they were left to find their own way into circulation. Connecticut in June of 1709 made its first emission of bills for 8,000 pounds. Soon followed 11,000 more, which were to be in equal value to money and to be accordingly accepted in all public payments. New York in November of 1709 had entered into the defense of its northern frontier and for the first time involved itself in the use of bills of credit. Rhode Island in July of 1710 and November of 1711, South Carolina in July of 1712, Massachusetts in 1712, Massachusetts again in 1714, Massachusetts in 1716, Massachusetts in March of 1721 and 1728, New Hampshire in 1717, Connecticut in 1718, Pennsylvania in March of 1723, Maryland in 1733, brought 90,000 pounds in its bills of credit into circulation by loans at 4%. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, the creation of paper money didn't originate with Franklin D. Roosevelt or the Federal Reserve Bank in 1913. We Americans have had a long and distressing relationship with paper money from the time that we first got here. And we started in earnest in 1690. Well, by 1756 or so, listen to this. The next development of the colonial system of paper money was a partial repudiation and recognition of the evils of such a practice. The people of South Carolina had already recorded their sense of their mistake in the statute of the 11th of December 1717, in which they said, quote, "It is found by experience that the multiplicity of the bills of credit hath been the cause of the ruin of our trade and commerce and hath been the great evil of this province, and that it ought with all expedition to be remedied." Now, boys and girls, it wasn't very long until the paper money and the inflation that ensued became a distressing and perplexing vexation on trade, commerce, business, and industry in the colonies. And they recognized that this wasn't one of our brighter moves. Now, you'd say to yourself, well, surely if this had happened back in colonial times, we would have learned from that and our government wouldn't allow it to happen again. Oh, no. They remedied it in the 1750s, and then they went in and did the same thing again to finance the Revolutionary War. You see, every time that there's a problem like the Civil War, the Revolutionary War, the War of 1812, politicians always go to credit. They always go to paper money. Why? Well, because it's expedient. It's easy. It's like a heroin addict. You know, kicking the habit's hard. Shooting up is easy, pleasurable, fun. Inflating the currency, everybody enjoys it because there's a momentary kick. There's a stimulus that comes into the economy. You know, prices may go up, but they don't go up in the morning. First thing that happens is that the money hits the marketplace, and it's easier to borrow money. It's easier to do business. It's easier to buy a house. It's easier to get a job. And boys and girls, if there's something that we all love, it's easy. That's why they call New Orleans the Big Easy. It's easy to get a job. It's easy to borrow money. It's easy to buy a house. And the money is flowing. Let the good times roll. And that's what inflation offers. That's what paper money offers. That's what we all want. Now, of course, it's like taking heroin. I remember years ago, I was in the hospital. I had some surgery done, had a little accident, and they had to do a little reconstruction in the hospital, a little surgery involved. And the doctor came in, and there was some pain that went along with this surgery. And they had a shot of morphine there, and the doctor said to me, he said, "You're going to like this." And they gave me that shot of morphine, and the doctor was right. If there's anything better than a hit of morphine, I don't know what it is. Boy, I just really enjoyed that morphine. And they came back about every few hours, and they gave me another shot of morphine. God, it was the greatest stuff. I can see why heroin addicts like heroin. I can see why cocaine and marijuana and alcoholics like alcohol, marijuana, cocaine, heroin, because it feels so good, boys and girls. You know, people don't smoke because it hurts. People don't drink because it don't feel good. People aren't going down to Flo's Whorehouse because there's pain involved. We do those things that are pleasurable, that are easy, that don't require any sweat or perspiration. Inflation is one of those. God, it just feels so good. Now, on the 9th of January, 1739, the General Court of Massachusetts made this confession. Now, this is the General Court of Massachusetts, January 1739. They said, quote, "The emission of great quantities of bills of public credit without certain provision for their redemption by lawful money in convenient time hath already stripped us of all of our money and brought them into contempt to the great scandal of the government. For the remedy thereof, this province has fixed the value of their bills in lawful money and the time of their redemption in 1742. Unquote. Well, the year 1742 came and went. And the people did not find any relief, and the government had not redeemed their bills of credit. So in 1744, James Allen, the preacher of the annual election sermon, addressed the governor from the pulpit. And he said, quote, "Be the means of delivering us from the perplexing difficulties that we are involved in by an unhappy medium, uncertain as the wind, the land mourneth. And the cries of many are going up into the ears of the Lord of Sabbath." Unquote. Well, in February of 1748, Massachusetts invited the governors of Connecticut, New Hampshire, and Rhode Island to join in abolishing the use of bills of credit. But as no one of the three gave effectual heed to the summons, the people of Massachusetts proceeded on their own. So in 1749, Massachusetts passed an act redeeming the bills of the old tender at the rate of 45 shillings, those of the new tender at the rate of 11 shillings and 3 pence, for one Spanish milled silver dollar. Now, the bills of credit of New Hampshire, Rhode Island, and Connecticut were excluded by most stringent laws from being used in the colony of Massachusetts. So Massachusetts then, with its quickened industry and established credit, subsequently sat as the queen among the provinces. In January of 1751, Great Britain enacted that no paper currency or bills of credit of any kind issued in any of the said colonies or plantations shall be a legal tender in payment of any private dues whatsoever within any of them. And Adam Smith wrote that no law could be more equitable. Adam Smith wrote in his work called A Caveat Against Injustice or an Inquiry into the Evil Consequences of a Fluctuating Medium of Exchange. Roger Sherman, the great statesman from Connecticut, wrote the following in 1752. He said, quote, "Money ought to be something of certain value. Money being that whereby other things are to be valued. And this I would lay down as a principle that cannot be denied, that a debtor ought not to pay any debts with any less value than was contracted for without the consent of or against the will of his creditor. If what is used as a medium of exchange is fluctuating in its value, it is no better than unjust weights and measures, both which are condemned by the laws of God and man, and therefore the largest and most universal custom could never make the use of such a medium either lawful or reasonable. But so long as we part with our most valuable commodities for such worthless bills of credit as are of no profit to us, we shall spend a great part of our labor and of our substance for that which will not profit us. Whereas if those things were reformed, we might be as independent and as flourishing and happy a colony as any in the British dominions." Unquote. Roger Sherman. Now, this fellow Roger Sherman was instrumental at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 when they wrote into our Constitution that no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. And I might point out that there are three statutes in the Bible that prohibit the use of these bills of credit, paper money. That is the law that says thou shalt not steal, supported by the statute that says you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag. Now, you'll find those two statutes in Leviticus 19, 35 and 36, and in Deuteronomy 25, verses 13 through 16. And thou shalt not steal in Exodus chapter 20 and Deuteronomy chapter 5. Four most valuable words in business: thou shalt not steal. Now, paper money or inflation in America from the beginning of the Seven Years' War to the Constitutional Convention of the United States, that is from 1756 to 1787. Connecticut, in 1756, excluded the bills of paper money of Rhode Island and redeemed every 9 shillings of its paper money with 1 shilling in specie. Now, did you get that? Now, you've got 9 shillings worth of paper money. Let's just say that's $9. That's a 9-to-1 redemption. You can get $1 worth of gold, $1 worth of silver for every $9 that you bring in to be redeemed. The experience of paper money from 1690 to 1756 had an average loss of 90%. So far, the loss in American dollars from 1930 to 2005 is 97%. We lost 7% more than our forefathers have so far, and we haven't lost it all yet, because most Americans have everything that they own denominated in dollars. Your home is denominated in dollars. So you have this $500,000 luxury California home, in which you owe $300,000 and have a $200,000 equity. When the economy turns turtle, your payments will remain the same, but you'll be unemployed, out of a job, or trading in your money for $9 worth of paper will be redeemed with $1 worth of gold or silver, or with the new currency, or with purple money, blue money, yellow money, green money, or red money, or something else. When you can't make your payments, your house will be taken away from you, and you will lose your $200,000 equity. Now, if you sold your house today and you took the $200,000 in equity and you put it into gold or silver coin or a combination of the two, or you bought wheat, corn, beans, honey, or oil, or anything of substance, and then kept that, you would still have that to use later on. And when housing, that is house values, the price of housing fell in 1989 in California, it fell 40%. So if you had a $500,000 house times 0.40, you would lose $200. You'd still have $300 left. So you lost $200,000. Now, if you had $200,000 in equity, you weren't hurting. But if you didn't have $200,000 in equity, let's suppose you had $100,000, now you've got a $300,000 house that you owe $400,000 on. That's not a very enviable place to be. That's coming. That's what happens in hyperinflation. We like to think that hyperinflation is going to inflate us right along with everything else. I once was a business associate with a fellow in California. We call this leverage. That's where you go out today and you buy a piece of property. And let's say that the piece of property is worth $500,000 and you buy it for $50,000. And then you have a mortgage for $450,000. And the value of this property over the next 5 years goes up to $1 million. It doubles in value. And you've had tenants in this building and they've been making the payments for you. You sell the building and you make a $500,000 profit over the 5-year period. That's called leveraging. Very profitable, very common, very useful. If the economy doesn't go into hyperinflation or the economy doesn't collapse like it did in Germany, that's a good way to make money. But where we are perched today in 2005 is not the same place that we were perched in 1979, 1965, or 1942. We're now perched on the verge of hyperinflation. In order for hyperinflation to work for you, then the prices, as they escalate, have to be followed by wage gains or price increases that are commensurate with this escalating price. Now, here's what just happened in Argentina. So this is what you can be looking forward to. This is the model that's going to be played out in the United States. About 2001, they couldn't meet their payments. We Americans are on the verge of, it won't be long until we can't meet our payments. When you can't meet your payments, your creditors stop lending you any more money. And you go on what's known as COD, cash on delivery. Today, when we want a shipload of oil from Saudi Arabia, we just write out an IOU and say, okay, Saudis, here's the check. It's in the mail. The Saudis take our check and they keep shipping oil. When the Saudis take the check to the bank and the check bounces, are they going to continue to send you oil when they can't get payment? The check bounces. Payment's no good. When that occurs, the Saudis will say, from now on, you got to send us Caterpillar tractors to pay for the boatload of oil. That's called barter. You got to send us gold or silver or euros or some other currency that we know has some purchasing power, some value. Well, in Argentina, what's happened over the last few years is their unemployment rate went to 62%, which means that there's a downward pressure on wages. A guy that's working for $10 an hour has 62 people looking for his job, and those 62 people are willing to work for $8 an hour or $6 an hour or $4 an hour, and he finds himself out of work. And the guy that's working for $8 finds himself out of work. It has a downward pressure on wages. You find yourself working longer hours, making less money, and paying higher prices. That's the effects of hyperinflation. That's what's coming. Your taxes will go up on your property. Your $500,000 house will go down in value because there will be fewer and fewer people out there in the marketplace to buy it. And your taxes will go up, up, and up. You'll be caught in a bind. While the value of your property is going down, the taxes on your property will be going up. And while your taxes are going up, your wages will be going down if, in fact, you're one of the 38% who still has a job. Not a very pleasant, not a very good thing to be looking forward to. All right, we're out of time. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. We'll be talking more about paper money in the American colonies and the Revolutionary War and what we did to solve that problem next time. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember that The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, we're going to drop it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So thanks for listening, and until then, good night, friends.